Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. Our attention turns locally this week as the country begins to take stock of the coronavirus impacts and look to the future for drivers of Australia's favourite asset class, property. As news breaks that lending standards are being relaxed and the Reserve Bank of Australia continues to pump freshly printed monopoly money into the economy through the new term funding facility, the bull case for Aussie property prices strengthens. But is it going to be enough to get it back in the saddle? With the easy demand tap of high international immigration still closed, and the prospect of economic Armageddon through currently undisclosed insolvencies and high unemployment, the traditional drivers of house price growth are still absent and tipped to be for the foreseeable future. And so the question remains, can government policy fire up and save Australian property demand internally against the present downside risks as the country looks to the post-COVID future? Clearly, a battle royale is ahead of us as the nation looks on with interest. Here to run through our thoughts and discuss how they may be incorporated in our portfolios, I'm joined by Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Hello to you, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
Also on the line, we have our Chief Strategist, David Llewellyn-Smith. G'day, David.
G'day, Tim.
And also joining us for some interesting views on the property bull case, we have our chief economist, Leith Van Onselen. Hello, Leith. Welcome back.
G'day, Tim. Hi, Tim.
And just a quick reminder that before we get started, to subscribe on YouTube and click the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, or follow us on your preferred podcast platform. And for those listening in live now, feel free to drop in your questions in the chat box at nucleuswealth.com/webinar or in the YouTube's comment box in YouTube itself to have them answered along the way. So let's jump into the agenda. So we're going to kick off with credit for everyone. We're then going to be looking at unemployment for a lot of people, looking at some stimulus cliffs, some other factors that can be affecting the property market as well, and then wrapping up, as we do, with our investment outlook and how we use these themes every day in the portfolios here at Nucleus Wealth and the MB Fund. So to get the ball rolling, a credit for everybody. Damien, you've made a mistake?
Yeah. So look, I just wanted to highlight, you know, so I wrote a piece on this the other day that I wanted to sort of talk about where we started from as we put together this calculator online. So what the idea was, and this was pre-COVID, was we had this view that interest rates, that the standard variable rates were pretty close to zero. There was only like one or two more cuts left. And that given the sensitivity of house prices to interest rates was that you're stuck in this catch-22 situation where if you thought the economy was going to improve, then interest rates would be increasing and that's going to cap house prices. And if you thought things were going to get worse, then you know, unemployment would rise and other factors, and that would then also affect house prices. So it sort of seemed like you know, the best you could hope for was a bit of a grind higher, and the worst was this was a lot of downside. And then though we've the coronavirus hit, and the RBA pretty quickly put in together this term funding facility called the TFF, and it's been trying to push 3-year mortgage rates down, and they've been quite successful. So you know, you can get rates of sort of, you know, between 2% and 3%. I think the across most 3-year loans at the moment. And that's come down a long way from where you were. So even though the actual rates that have only been cut
2%, Damon.
Sorry, 2%?
Yeah.
I guess if you're a lender, an investor.
It's
closer to 3. But close to 2% if you're a homeowner. And so the issue is that we'd sort of put into this calculator that 2% was a minimum interest rates you could go to. And the RBA has spoken in the past about, you know, not wanting to go below the current level that it's at the moment. We think it probably will go a bit lower. I mean, they've spoken a few times about not wanting to go lower, but they keep going lower. And if you look at the overseas, what's happening over there is that they've actually already put the Australia's basically put the same mechanism in that you're seeing in Europe. And in Europe, if you want to get a loan in, say, France or Germany, or if you're back in, say, if you're outside of Europe, but in Japan, if you want to get a loan, you can pick up housing loans for about 0.5%. So, and that's because they're actually paying negative interest on those loans. So if you went, so the idea is, what's stopping Australia from going down that same route? And the answer is not much. And we saw last week the Treasurer start talking about getting rid of responsible lending laws and letting banks lend irresponsibly. And, you know, I guess what we're sort of looking at now is saying, well, where it was a bit of a tail risk earlier on, it actually looks like the most likely outcome is that interest rates will go lower. And you'll sort of see the central bank, you know, it's almost as if the meetings and whatever they're putting for their actual rate is a bit unimportant now. It's really the real game is what they're doing with this TFF and what interest rates are going to charge on that. Dave, do you want to get your...
So where are we? We're on credit for everyone?
Yeah, just want to talk around your thoughts around these sort of idea that...
Okay, so the important point to note is that Aussie banks are funded, that is their liabilities, where they borrow money, to the tune of a little over 60% in deposits, and the other 40 or somewhere between 35 and 40 bounces around a bit percent is wholesale funding, which is basically various forms of borrowing from investors. So the difficulty for the banks is when interest rates fall to zero, there's only so low they can take their deposit rates. So they're more or less there. They might be able to crunch them down a little bit further, but not much. And so as interest rates hit this lower bound, the cash rate, I mean, that starts to squash bank margins because they're having to cut mortgage rates, but they can't cut their deposit rates anymore. But what this RBA facility, the TFF, can do is essentially refinance the wholesale debt part of the bank's liabilities. That's roughly 40% of their funding. And so at the moment, that's a mix, roughly 50-50 of short-term funding and long-term funding. And I can't be precise about what the interest rate that the banks pay is on all of that, but it's sort of somewhere between 1% and 2% on all of those liabilities. And so that's actually quite high relative to what the central bank can provide, which in effect it can provide for free. I mean, at the moment it's only charging 0.25 of a percent on an interest rate. And so you've immediately there got 40% of the bank funding that can be cut from somewhere around 1% or a bit above to 0.25 if you continue to essentially nationalise those liabilities via the RBA. Now, as Damo said, the RBA has always said it won't do this kind of stuff, but then it always said it would never cut rates. It's resisted everything all the way down. And as we know, it is really just a bubble manager these days. It barely even considers the wider economy. When we get these various information dumps from people who've sought public disclosure, there's always this great paranoia in the bank about their little bubble, or large bubble, I should say. And so, it looks like they'll simply be forced to go further and further down this path. Now, they say that they won't take interest rates negative, but already they said they wouldn't go below 2.25, and they're going to go to 0.1 in, you know, like 2 months later, 3 months later. And that's on the cash rate. And they, you know, they can cut the rate on the term funding facility as well. In fact, they can make it negative if they want to. So, at this point, you have to look at other examples of central banks that have done similar stuff. And we can look to Europe in particular, where they have this thing called the TLTRO at the ECB, which is very similar. And it's now funding the banks there to the tune, I think, of up to 50% of their assets. They can finance out of the TLTRO. as low as minus 100 basis points. So the ECB is paying the banks to lend, in effect, paying them a yield to lend up to half of their entire book.
Yeah. Now, and actually, just put that in perspective, Dave. That's where you go. So you get your you know, if I'm in Germany and I take out a mortgage and I'm paying 0.5%, then I'm paying, you know, I'm paying my interest to the bank of 0.5%, and then the central bank is turning around and doubling what I've given and giving that money to the bank as well.
Exactly. Just for
they're basically saying, as long as you can find somebody, you know, foolish enough to take out a loan, we'll double their interest.
Now, the problem here is that they are still having to pay positive interest rates on their deposits. And so, in effect, what happens as this process transpires is the bank's margins continue to get squeezed. And in Europe, this has basically killed their banking sector. The value of their banking sector, the equity, has just been falling there for 10 years. And so, you know, this is kind of the quandary that this policy sequence throws up, excuse me, is eventually that both the central bank and fiscal authorities who can actually not necessarily go this way, they can instead print the money for themselves and just do lots of fiscal, but that's just not the way they think. They like to boost house prices, especially this government. And so they're always underdoing fiscal and driving the RBA to these more extreme easing measures. But what it does eventually is both authorities are faced with this terrible quandary between inflating the bubble and killing their banks. And so it's a sort of creeping nationalization of the banking system that defends your asset price bubble. And, you know, when you ask yourself which way Australian authorities will go on that, you know, they're very fond of the banks, and the banks are certainly very powerful in terms of, you know, political economy access, lobbying and what have you, especially with the coalition, but, you know, really across the board, you know, it'll happen with resistance, but, you know, Gab, the banks don't vote, and households love them. Enough households have mortgages and love their bubble enough that you know they really have no choice in the end but to vote with households. And so you end up killing your banking system but sustaining your bubble as long as you possibly can.
So I was just going to say, Tim, if you can flip back a chart to that TFF, the wholesale funding one, just to sort of illustrate that point, Dave, I mean, we've only had this round for about 6 months or less than 6 months.
Yeah.
Already it's been increased twice. So there was was like the initial amount, and then there was a supplementary amount, and then there's an additional amount on top of that. Like the amount that's actually being lent through this is just increasing every time the banks need some more cheap equity.
Yep, and you can see that the wholesale funding is commensurately crashing as the TFF takes off.
So we're closing in on 100 billion already.
Yes, that's right, and they only need 500 to nationalise the entire lot. So, you know, I mean, a couple of years would be easy peasy. And in truth, even if you end up with that kind of level, you're still going to be far behind most other central banks in terms of comparable size of central bank assets to GDP, etc. Perhaps not in terms of assets to the banking system. I can't actually tell you off the top of my head what that would look like relative to others, but certainly in terms of GDP, it would still be relatively small. So anyway, in short, you know, when we cross over to the next chart, not good for banks. It's really not good for households or anybody else either. We've already played the debt card for 30 years. We've got insane household debt. What would be a much better idea is to actually do some of this to crush mortgage rates, but at the same time tighten macroprudential policy so that it didn't get into mortgage debt. What happened instead was households could deleverage with the lower rates, plus it would be funneled much more fully into a falling currency as you smash your yields. But they won't do that. And, you know, arguably they can't even do it because APRA and the RBA are separate, and it's APRA that controls macroprudential. And they don't really consider these large macroeconomic questions, and the government wouldn't want them to do it. anyway. It's all about house prices. So it looks increasingly likely that this is the road we will be kind of shoved down almost by inertia, but, you know, through a range of the usual political economy corruptors, you know, a broken monetary policy system, a government that has no better idea, and really, as we can see today with its attempted manufacturing rebirth, just doesn't understand alternative economic models.
So no, can also can also just add, Dave, it's also, you know, this will also be disastrous for the nation's retirement savings, because obviously if the banks, if the Australian banks end up getting their returns smashed, we know that the banks, the bank sector makes up a huge proportion of Australia's superannuation pool. And obviously, you know, that's going to put a strain on the nation's retirement savings, whether it's bank dividends, whatever. So you effectively have to nationalise the retirement system as well, as a secondary impact. So it's you know, we're talking about changes all over the place here.
Yeah, it's madness from top to bottom. It's what we should be looking at. What all of this is just more and more extreme attempts to sustain the unsustainable with cyclical policy tools, when we should have 10 years ago, and as we keep saying, certainly today, be looking at structural policy change. Structural economic reform is the only way out of this, but the coalition has no idea how to do it. Business has no idea how to do it. The business media has no idea how to do it. It's a wash now of interests that are all on board with this cyclical policy making. And so that's what we do. And what's at the end of this is just Japan. I mean, it's just
a zombie economy.
A zombie economy. It's just endless stagnation, you know, slow nationalization of the banking system, but secretly, so that the bankers keep their big bonuses and the taxpayer just gets reamed. And it's really it really is a slow erosion and death of, you know, a market economy without ever actually saying so.
You know, that's that thing with the Europe, isn't it? Like the time period David's showing in that chart, we were showing that chart where the European banks are down 50% is roughly the time at which this started, and maybe a little bit longer ago, and just they gradually ratcheted down the rates. But it's almost as if they picked the name, you know, TLTRO or whatever they've called it, with the idea that most people's eyes are going to glaze over just hearing the acronym, let alone trying to work out what the hell it's doing. Yes. And it's similar with the this term funding facility. Idea is that it's, you know, there's a lot of banker speak and a lot of stuff that's all wound up, but in the end, it's basically a gift to the banks. Yes. If you explain to the Australian people, you know, we're making this big gift to the banks, that they'd obviously be more upset than if it's, you know, some arcane banker speak about, you know, 3-year funding costs, where most people's eyes just glaze over and it's like, oh well, I'm assuming they're doing the right thing.
So there's another final component to this, which is probably, you know, the most important in terms of driving this, and that is that this is not a one-way ticket to higher house prices here. Basically, we have a stuffed economy post-COVID. That's the real driver. I'm saying that we should be addressing this with structural change, but they're not going to do that. It's going to be cyclical, but the driver itself of a weak economy is absolutely locked in. And there's a couple of different measures we can give you for that as we go through. Post-COVID unemployment is immense. It's going to be really, really sticky with this weak economy. Everyone still wants to talk about unemployment, as Leith wrote this week. You know, they want to get it below 6% before they start cutting fiscal, but that's absurd, because underemployment is the measure that matters today. It's the only thing that inflation tracks and wages is underemployment.
But also not even that. If the government uses 6% as the employment trigger, well, we've only been at 6% a couple of times in the last decade. Like that is exactly. Still way above full employment anyway.
It is so, way above, and way above Nauru and everything else, which is down somewhere below 4.
Yeah, actually, sorry, Leith, maybe it might be good if you explain a little bit more about what's wrong with the current employment stats, because you know, we obviously had the treasurer a couple of months ago saying, here's what the official stats are, but you actually need to add in all this extra stuff to get to a more realistic number so you can see how the economy is going. And so the official unemployment rate is basically not worth the paper it's at the moment.
That's right. It was 6.something%. I can't remember. I, to be honest with you, I barely even look at it anymore because it's so useless. But it was about 6.4, I think, percent was the official unemployment rate. But that is grossly estimated because it doesn't include obviously those people on JobKeeper that are that aren't working any hours. So those people should also be included. It also doesn't include discouraged workers. So those people who aren't actively looking for work because there are no jobs aren't counted as unemployed. So we tend to look at alternative measures. Roy Morgan's unemployment measure seems a lot more realistic. That's currently got unemployment at 13.8%, which is probably a little bit too high. I think estimates of the effective rate of unemployment, which take into account JobKeeper and discouraged workers, is around 10%. But probably the thing to look at in this isn't really the levels. It's more the trends and which way it's going. So whether you use, Roy Morgan or not, the fact of the matter is unemployment is a lot higher than it was. And also the number of hours worked, which is also probably one of the better measures that is harder to aim, is also down about 6% as well from its peak. So, whichever way you cut it, we're obviously facing very high unemployment and it could get a lot worse as the emergency income supports are unwound over the next 6 months.
Which brings us to the second reason we're going to have a weak economy, and that is fiscal's going to be cut. If we go to our next chart, it's going to be cut severely by about 10% of GDP annualized over 6 months. Now, there will be a private economy picking up to offset that, but it's still a huge, huge smash. And then into 21-22 budget, you'll see at least $100 billion less in fiscal, if not more.
And it all started this week because this week we saw a JobKeeper cut and as well as a JobKeeper supplement. So basically from now is when you're going to start to feel this.
That's right. And what's leaked in the budget? Yeah, they're doing some stuff and on some measures it's substantial, but it's poorly targeted and pretty poorly conceived. The tax cuts aren't going to do a great deal because they're for... as we know, higher income earners, JobKeeper and JobSeeker are both going to be slashed. They probably will sustain the higher JobSeeker amount, the reduced higher amount, which is a good thing. But there's not enough investment, infrastructure investment. They're only talking $10 or $20 billion to be sort of co-invested with the states. It should be 100. Some real nation building oomph is what they need, but they're not going to do it. And I think the reason for that, pure and simple, is they want to smash the RBA down. They really don't want to kill rates as low as they can and get house prices moving. So fiscal's not going to be enough, it looks like. And then we have our last serious headwind, and this is just a massive thing for the southeast, the major two capitals of Sydney and Melbourne, is... The virus has killed mass immigration, stone dead, for the next 2 years at least. For all of the associated sectors, this is just, it's anything from a severe headwind to just a complete implosion. So that's housing construction, banks, retail, all of the Ponzi sectors that we love to put the boot into, they're all going to suffer for a couple of years at least. And Sydney and Melbourne were very immigration dependent economies. And so we're seeing, very, very heavy headwinds emanating from that in those two cities, especially because so much of their growth was driven by immigration based construction. And that's leading to all sorts of oversupply and difficulty for property prices as well. So what we've kind of set up there is, the mother of all arm wrestles between a very weak economy with insufficient fiscal spending, one of its key growth drivers knocked out for years in immigration, versus historically crazy attempts to boost credit both by availability and price, which, you know, because of the mix of the other stuff, is kind of going to happen by default. Because, you know, you're going to have no inflation, you're going to have trouble growth, high unemployment, and all these things mean that the RBA is forced to just go deeper and deeper into unconventional policy. Even though it won't want to and it will fight it, it'll have no choice. So, Damo, do you want to maybe go through your chart here on how we kind of add up these various forces?
Yeah, and so... what I think the key part to this next table is basically they're not hugely scientific, but it's basically our feel of how each of these factors has been changing over these different periods. And so a number of demand factors, number of supply factors, the green arrows are basically saying they're going up and that's helping to push prices up, and the red arrows is helping to push prices down. And so the real message from this is we had this boom from 2012 to 2017 in the eastern states, and basically had everything going for it. Credit was booming, you know, the price of credit, employment, you know, you just go through every single box, you can tick them all. And then into 2018, we ended up with this bust where a few things eased off, but really the major thing was that the credit availability pulled back as the Royal Commission was going on, and banks were worried that they might actually be asked to or held to account for the irresponsible lending that had been done. Then that happened, you know, the election happened, and the federal government, you know, then started exhorting banks to get out and start lending irresponsibly again. And so that meant we were sort of left in this period, a bit of a stasis, sort of pre-COVID, where prices were ticking up. You know, credit availability was sort of good in some bits and sort of bad in others. But generally speaking, you know, we had all right conditions. And now we've hit this final stage now, or maybe, hopefully it's not final, but, you know, we've hit this next stage where, you know, credit is going to go ballistic. We think the price of credit is definitely up a lot already. It's, you know, it's come down significantly in terms of those 3-year rates. But, you know, on the flip side, you're facing, as I said, those huge negative winds on the other side. The tax incentives, look, we've said it's quite positive. It's probably more that we think it's going to be, we think there'll be more to come. So, as opposed to there being, you know, massive amounts right now. Foreign buyers is probably a little bit of a question mark. We've said it's probably negative, which we think's right, but you know, it could be very negative, or maybe there'll be a flow from Hong Kong and it might be positive at some stage. And then the under oversupply part is, there's probably an undersupply coming at some stage, a couple of years down the track. But at the moment, we're still finishing off all the projects that were put in place a few years ago to try to chase prices higher. So
we think definitely oversupply for the next 2 years.
Look, all you have to do is look at what's happening to rents at the moment. So in the last 6 months alone, apartment rents across Sydney and Melbourne have fallen by 5%, according to the Call. And house rents are down about 1%. They're also down nationally. So that to me just tells you that without immigration, obviously we've had high unemployment and job losses, but with that, and we've got this still a very high pipeline of apartments that are still being constructed from a couple of years back. So I think we're not just looking at small oversupply. I think we're looking at a very big oversupply with falling rents.
And then the next part, the big question then is saying, okay, well, when you get this big burst of credit versus an employment shock, you know, who wins? You know, is it the immovable force meets the, or is it irresistible force meets the immovable object? And, you know, the best indication we can give is looking back at Perth, which is on the next slide. So Perth, over that same 2014 to 2018, Perth prices fell, you know, about 10% over that time period. And at the same time, they had exactly the same credit availability. They had the same price of credit. So they still had those big positive signs coming towards the Perth economy. But their unemployment was rising. And that's where, you know, I guess our sort of all else being equal, and we've got a few different views on this. So let me give mine first, and then we might hand it to Leith for his. But, you know, I'm looking at these two forces and saying, depends who hits first. If we dropped interest rates tomorrow to 0.5% and the RBA started funding the Australian banks by 1% to, in order to get these loans out there as cheaply as possible, then I could see house prices going up. How long for? You know, it's this question of like you basically shooting all your stimulus before you've even really had your problem. And so it's sort of leaving you nothing left when you do have a problem. But I can certainly see that happening. The flip side is if house prices start to get, if you start seeing companies are allowed to go bankrupt again, tenants are allowed to be kicked out of their house for not paying the rent. Like if those measures come in and that turns the house and banks actually start wanting people to actually pay interest on the loans, and that means that you start getting some selling going. And that once that snowball gets going, I don't think you can throw as much credit as you want at it. Nobody's going to want to borrow if every day it's talking about, you know, house prices down 5%, house prices down 10%, you know, will it reach 30% down or whatever it is. Doesn't matter how much credit, that'll help pick you up the bottom. But if you let that snowball get rolling too fast, there's no stopping it. So I guess I'm sort of a little bit, I think to me the we've got negative drift, like so it's more likely that we're going to have a negative outcome out of this. But maybe they'll come good on way too much stimulus way too early, and we'll have a small house price boom before we run out of land under our feet. So Leith, I think you've got a bit of a different view.
Yeah, look, not massively different. Probably a bit more bullish, I guess. Which, you know, everyone, if you're listening to this, pin this time, because it's, you know, it's probably the first time you ever hear me actually talking bullish. you know, on at least on recent podcasts. But look, there's obviously been a lot of talk here about the cost of credit coming down, and all those points are well made. To me, the bigger issue is actually the availability of credit. You know, the cost of credit basically determines whether or not you want a loan, right? Whether or not you want to out and try and buy a house, etc. And obviously, the cheaper money is, the more you want that loan. But for me, it's the availability of credit that's more important, because the availability of credit determines how much you can borrow. And also, it also determines, you know, whether subprime people can actually are allowed to borrow. And to me, last week's announcement by Treasurer Josh Frydenberg to axe responsible lending laws is a potential game changer. Now, this assumes it obviously passes the parliament. But if that comes in, we could see a situation where basically anybody with a pulse can get a loan, and it'll mean that a lot of subprime borrowers that previously couldn't get finance will be sucked into the market. It also means that
I'm pretty sure the Royal Commission showed you didn't need a pulse.
That's right. But
there are a bunch of people who got debt that were dead.
There was life insurance. You know, I'm sure they could extend it to home loans. But yeah.
Well, basically, my understanding of these proposed laws is that it is totally up to the borrower to give lawful disclosures about what they can afford, so the banks aren't required to be responsible. So that to me just means, well, you know, if we're not responsible, let's go out and. So as I said, what it means it'll suck in a whole bunch of subprime borrowers that couldn't previously get finance, but also more importantly, will allow, you know, someone in a position who previously could borrow, say, $500,000, to then be able to borrow $700,000, which obviously massively increases the ability to borrow. And also, you know, will bid up house prices, other things equal. But of course, all these negative headwinds that we've talked about are still there. So it's still an arm wrestle. It's just that I think the scales have probably been tipped to rising prices next year. And if we go to the next chart and actually look at it, the market has become a two-speed housing market. So I've got a chart here showing quarterly price growth. Quarterly price growth across all capitals has clearly turned. Sydney and Melbourne still fall, though Sydney is falling at a much, much slower rate. And its auction clearance rates are actually running at roughly the same levels as last year. So Sydney's actually looking like it's picking up. Melbourne's obviously the key drag. Obviously, with the lockdowns, the economy's stuffed here. We've got no immigration. And I can see Melbourne continuing to fall just because of the weakness of the economy. But all the other markets in Australia, the ones that aren't immigration dependent, the ones that basically haven't experienced any material price growth in real terms over the last decade. We're talking Brisbane, Perth, which has fallen, and Adelaide are looking like they're going to have some pretty decent price growth. I mean, nothing off the hook, but I can see, you know, those markets combined alongside Sydney pretty much holding its own will be enough to potentially, you know, lift property prices in 2021. Now, if you were to say to me a month ago, I would have said, nah, come on, you're dreaming. But this prospect of having mortgage rates cut, but more importantly, much easier lending standards is a potential game changer. And that's why it's pretty much changed my view from being very bearish to being, you know, neutral to, I wouldn't say bullish, but more neutral as we have this arm wrestle. So I don't know what you guys think, but to me, it's the easing of lending standards that's more important than the cost of credit.
Yeah. I'll weigh in at this point. I agree with pretty much all of that, except to say that I can't see why Labor would allow the passage of the removal of responsible lending standards. Like the responsible lending legislation was theirs, the Royal Commission was theirs. You know, they obviously have made a lot of political capital out of pursuing the banks over the last 5 years. They're not as close to the banks as the government. Excuse me. And then I would have thought there's a pretty easy political gain here because, yes, I know it means that some people won't get credit, but it's pretty easy to mount the argument that you don't want reckless, irresponsible banks 18 months after they've all been paraded in the docks. So I do wonder if they're going to get that through. That being said, if that doesn't happen, then I think that the RBA going even deeper is even more likely. And so I agree all that ex-Southeast, I think property prices are going to rise. I think Melbourne's obviously the laggard and is just going to struggle no matter. It's such an immigration-centric economy. It's got a lot of deflation to work its way through, and I think Sydney will struggle too. Probably the base case for Sydney is more of a kind of post-millennial bust scenario where, you know, it didn't go anywhere for nearly a decade. And that was supported by very strong immigration and very high income growth and very high rental growth in that period. So I think Sydney will also struggle, certainly do a bit better than Melbourne, but nothing like the other caps. So a very bifurcated outlook is what I would say.
Yep, fair enough.
David, just on that, I guess, do you think this could be, is this sort of like turning into perhaps a political wedge though, where Liberals, you know, let's say there is a big house blowout and, you know, for all the reasons that we've covered off today, and then, you know, next election they can turn around and say, well, look, you know, Labor have done this now. You know, we tried to put things in place and they were stymied, even if obviously they
did on the nose. Look, they could try that, but the moral ballast is still all on Labor's side. I mean, you had a horrendous Royal Commission. It really was horrendous. It's only 18 months ago.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to do is say, look, this is corruption.
Yeah, and the other thing though is, if house prices were down, then the Labor would be turning around saying, "Look at all this money they were trying to pump more debt into you, and we were trying to protect you." And look, house prices fell, and so didn't we do a great job making sure more people didn't lose money?
And that all being said, like Labor might just choose, because it's choosing to do this on every issue, to just be the empty chair. I mean, the Albo government appears to have just decided that invisibility is its best chance of election. I think it may have been the case after the bushfires and pre-COVID, but simply letting the government rampage across all centrist policy making now, you know, unmitigated and unaccosted is, I mean, Labor looks just like it's going out of business, which isn't an alternative. It's just
I think it's a hangover from last election. I mean, Labor went with a really quite a robust policy platform and ended up getting cleaned out for it. So
yes,
so
absolutely, now, absolutely right. But so now it's, the question so, is, yes, well, it's well, yes, it is. But is, you know, is there's gun shy and then there's invisible.
Yeah, that's right.
Good. Another question that jumps to mind, and Damien, you know, mentioning, or you know, we're sort of positioning this potential for 0.5% mortgage rates, etc. Negative gearing. So with decreasing mortgage rates, you know, assuming you're buying the same amount of house and not spending, you know, epically amounts more, but is that, you know, is the case for a negative geared investor sort of driven market sort of eroding as mortgage rates come down?
Well, I need a bigger mortgage than Tim. you can't make a loss on your property, you know. You got to lend more. it's the unfortunate. Yeah.
Just on that, it's quite interesting. Obviously, Melbourne and Sydney for the last decade or so have been propelled by the investor mortgage side, whereas the other states have been. Now, the other jurisdictions have been more balanced, just a regular housing market. We've got a situation now where obviously interest rates are going to crash to incredibly low levels. And it's gotten to the stage now where outside of Sydney and Melbourne, you can get a gross rental yield now of 4% plus. So you're effectively could have a situation where, you know, even after costs, you're looking at a positive carry whereby
you can...
that's right, you do, but whereby you can pretty much get a positive cash flow property outside of Sydney and Melbourne. Even Sydney and Melbourne, if interest rates go that low, even with, you know, rental yields of, you know, 3% or net 2% net after costs, still looking at not too much gearing required. So, you know, at the moment, obviously investors have left the market, but if interest rates do go down that low, I can see a lot of them coming back. And it could actually turn Australia away from being a negatively geared nation towards maybe a positively geared nation, because let's face it, if returns are bad on everything, where will put your money? Yeah. You got to put it in assets.
The flip side though, Leith, is, you know, as we were speaking before, if the epicenter of this is actually rents dropping because we haven't got anyone moving in, you know, and you're just seeing, and you've seen it already across, you know, not multiple ones. That's why if you know, there's obviously some true believers in terms of property saying, you know, yeah, property price is going to go up all the time and I'll buy them because interest rates might go lower again. And so therefore I can make some money from it. But if you're actually a normal investor who wants to make money from property by renting it out and actually getting a yield on it, then you don't know whether coronavirus comes back and all of a sudden you're not allowed to collect your rent because your tenant's lost their job and they've decided they're not going to pay. Or you don't know if your rental yield's just going to keep falling and falling, or you'll all of a sudden you'll be empty for 3 months because, you know, rental vacancies are high and you can't find somebody to live there. So,
yeah, no, you are right, but that's really just a Sydney and Melbourne problem. Again, like I'm sort of talking more outside those two nations because you know, the high vacancy rates and obviously the big supply overhang is really just Sydney and Melbourne. The other capitals don't have that problem. They're actually getting tight in supply, and the vacancy rates are quite low. So, you know,
we're probably likely to see, certainly in Melbourne, but I would probably guess Sydney as well. We'll probably see domestic migration out of those two capitals and into the other states.
Yeah, Sydney's lost people for about the last 15 years. But the big one of the stories with Melbourne's massive population growth, we've obviously had big migration, big international migration. But Melbourne's got a lot of people from interstate in the last 15 years. I can see us going back to the sort of 1990s period where Melbourne actually lost people to interstate migration. So you know, with the economy being a basket case down here. And obviously the scarring from the whole COVID episode, I can see a lot of Melburnians moving up north to Queensland. And to be quite honest with you, I'd be with them if I could.
You finish.
No, I was just going to say one of the worst things for me to watch is that I've had this plan for about 5 years to move to Queensland. And unfortunately, I can't get my wife over the line. But my plan has been to sell my house at a high price in Melbourne and buy a cheap house in Brisbane. And unfortunately, the way it's turning out is I can see Brisbane running up and Melbourne length, you know, being a laggard, which means I'm not going to get as much bang for my buck. So personally, I'm not happy about it.
There's one other sort of internal migration issue we haven't discussed, which is probably material. That's working from home. There's a lot of anecdotal reports of peripheral cities, yep. You know, like Geelong, Newcastle, Wollongong, these kinds of satellite cities to the big cities, or still enjoying rising prices today, simply because working from home has enabled everybody to do inner city jobs elsewhere, and so it seems pretty logical that we'd see that kind of trend continue as well, where you get a shift into the regions. And
yeah, the question I guess I've got for that, I actually had that down on my list of questions, though, is, you know, Australia is a very, very, very big place, and most of these regions have got lots and lots and lots of space. You know, I think I can't remember the exact stats, but it came down to basically if everyone wanted a half-acre block, you know, the entire of Australia could all live in the ACT. You know, it's a big place. And so these regional centres, it's more of a matter of saying, well, if land prices all of a sudden shoot up and somebody can just, you know, subdivide a block and put up a bunch of houses on there, then that'll bring them back down again. It's more of a supply demand mismatch at the moment, rather than saying, because at least there's an argument with some of the Sydney and Melbourne is, okay, there's these building constraints and it's a big city and it's locked in and all these arguments about, you know, having to backfill is very expensive, whereas a lot of these, you know, a lot of the regional areas you can build a lot more cheaply. So, you know, I guess that it might be a 2 or 3 year effect, but I guess what I'm saying is I wouldn't be rushing out and saying, hey, I can buy regional property and pick up this great gain while interest rates fall and we see this move to the regions, only to find that then you actually just get a bit of a building boom, which sort of evens that all out, and then you start getting the unemployment and the effect of no migration and everything starting to then and we've already shot all our loads in terms of lower interest rates, so you know your 2 or 3 year outlook might be quite good, but your 5 year or 5 or 10 year outlook on that property might actually be quite bad.
Leith, what about planning restrictions in the regions?
Yeah, so basically Australia's got restricted planning everywhere.
I can't hear you, mate.
Can't hear me?
A little bit louder, mate. Yep.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's better.
Okay, yeah. So, look, Australia's got restrictive planning restrictions everywhere. Doesn't matter where you're in the country. You've got to basically get a council approval to build anywhere, so you know it is restricted everywhere, which will dampen obviously the supply response. We don't have like a Texas style system, a Houston style system here, where pretty much anyone can buy a block of land and, you know, subdivide it. I can't remember what else I was going to say, but obviously
just mitigates against Damo's argument a little.
A little bit.
You can get a swift supply response even in the region.
Yeah, that's right. But at the same time,
that'd be particularly the case in the satellite towns too, right? I mean,
that's right.
Geelong, Newcastle, Wollongong, etc.
Yeah, but I guess I'm thinking more about some of the smaller ones. But I guess the thing as well, the difference there as well is in terms of swift response is it takes 2 or 3 years to get a block of units up. You know, if you're building a lot of houses, you can get them up, you know, within a year without too much of for bigger developers could certainly get it up, you know, quite even a lot faster than that.
And also the national broadband network has just promised to, you know, which is what they should have done initially, but to invest about $4 to improve broadband access, including in the bush. So if anything, you know, if you look 5 to 10 years down the road, internet access is only going to improve. And it's going to make this sort of telecommuting and work from home even easier. So I think these are long-term shifts that will dampen the, you know, capital city supply prices.
The other question for prices over this medium term, Leith, is that the other thing that weighs very heavily on me in terms of the employment side is we're going through a structural change, especially in Australia, in terms of saying Well, I think we are anyway, in terms of saying, okay, we've had all this, we've needed all these people in the, say, the tourism sector or the education sector or, pick whichever one you wanted in terms of the anything that's related to this big immigration. If that's not true for 2 years, then I don't think people are going to hang around waiting for their next, you know, if they're a tourism operator for overseas people giving tours, they're not going to wait around for 2 years for that to come back. They're going to go find another job elsewhere. And that's going to be difficult. I guess what I'm thinking is, to me, it's not a quick bounce back for the employment, because when you go through a structural change, you actually need people to find new jobs and new industries and all that type of stuff. And so there's that whole wave of people who are sort of out of the housing market and not sort of helping to lift.
Oh, absolutely. Look, I think Australia's going to have structurally high unemployment for a decade. Recoveries from recessions, deep recessions, is always very slow. And I think in this case, it's going to be particularly slow because we are going to get this huge structural change. Entire industries are going to be massively downsized. So you just have to look at the travel industry. Gyms, cafes, restaurants, all these sorts of things. If COVID hangs around for another year, even if we open up, more or less domestically, we're still going to have this social distancing type rules in place, and that's going to render a lot of businesses, make it very hard make it very hard for them to break a profit. I mean, if it costs you X number of rent per year to run a cafe, but you need to run it, certain amount of occupancy. If you halve that occupancy, it's going to make it very hard to survive. So, I think we're looking at. I still think we're looking at massive, massive dislocation, lots of business closures, structurally high unemployment, etc. Just whether or not
business closures start, and no lending in Australia has ever done on the back of a business actually having a business. It's all done in small businesses, it's all done on, have you got a house? Okay, put your house up as these businesses start falling over and banks start having to repossess houses, you're still confident low interest rates will be overwhelm that?
Not just low interest rates, ease lending standards as well. As I said before, I actually think the ease lending standards is more important than the cost of credit.
We've got, 120% of GDP at the moment-ish? Of home lending, how high can that go?
Who knows, mate? honestly, who knows? I certainly don't want to say I'm getting bullish on it, but I'm just I don't think a month ago I would have said, it's odds on bet we're going to get falling prices next year. I think there's a pretty good chance we're going to get rising prices by a bit. What happens down the road, down the track after that? Who knows? But let's just assume that mortgage rates do fall to say 1%, right? And you do have this easing lending standards. That would result in one more. That would inevitably be capitalised into house prices some way.
Absolutely. I just wonder if you've actually got enough time to. Let's say I was buying and selling. I'm not sure you could go out and buy something now. And even if that happened in the right order, you'd be able to get out in time, and make a profit on it, because you big costs in and big costs out. That's a bit I'm looking at and saying, I can see these scenarios in the perfect case for the housing market, that we get this low lending, we get all the taps open up, they keep throwing out and say, no, companies can't go bankrupt, people can't get kicked out of houses. And then eventually you get to this stage with, whether it's a year, 2 years, 3 years, where you've got these house prices starting to tick up. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, okay, now we actually do have to let companies go broke. Now we do have to start kicking people out of houses for not paying their rent. And then you start getting the momentum heads in the other direction. And when that momentum starts heading the other direction, you're like, oh, great, let's lower interest rates. Oh, no, we can't. We've already done that. Let's put first home buyer. Oh, no, we can't. We've already done that. Let's give them tax credits. Oh, no, we've already done that. Like it's the same argument, the same problem we've got. We're trying to throw all this extra thing on it just to try and hold house prices where they are. So I guess that's what I'm worried is that it might be maybe an 18-month to 2-year trade.
Absolutely, it's a giant can kick, and there is a bad end game to this. I mean, going down this road leads to a bad end game. Whether that's you eventually get a housing bust or just a zombie economy. It's kicking the can like this is never good. And but you know, we've been doing this for 10 years. We've been kicking the can, or you know, at least 7 years since they should have bought in Macroprudential. You know, we had the opportunity to deleverage. Mm. But I'm just saying that there is a distinct possibility that we could get one last roll of the dice, and yep. one last blow off where lower mortgage rates and easing standards capitalise into prices. And then after that, we'll be in a diabolical situation where I think you would be legitimately out of ammunition.
You just keep paying the banks more to
2%
to push the mortgage crack and until they're paying people to take on debt. Yeah.
but it's also like
that's being facetious. You kill the banking system and you're stuffed.
Yeah, but and also you're never raising rates ever again because you've got so much. I mean, we've already got a problem where we can't raise rates because there's so much debt in Australia that you just can't raise rates without smashing.
Yeah, that's right.
So you're just like...
Yeah, no, this is genuinely the path to Japanification.
Mm. Yep.
This is a zombie economy at the end of this. And when we say the end, I mean, we're at the end.
But we're just extending the end.
Well, we're just, you know, it's just more of the same and you just get worse and worse.
Have another
just
drink.
Band-aid.
Have another
just
drink. Band-aid. We'll get that hangover.
Yeah. Just Band-Aids and pop of Band-Aids.
Yeah, that's right. So we should add, like, the only way you kind of come out of this in the end, I think, is if somewhere else, I don't think it's going to happen here first, but somewhere else important enough to change, you know, market normatives, decides that MMT is okay. And so all of this printed money starts going into public investment instead worldwide, and you start to get rising wages and inflation and some rising interest rates. And so then you're on your way back out of it. Obviously, that has enormous problems of its own. Don't get me wrong, it's no panacea, but at least it would end this endless deflationary spiral.
Yeah, that's right. But we need a politician who's actually, yeah, I mean, we're at least 4 years away from doing it in the US, probably more likely to be 8 or 12. And then, and that's probably that'd probably be your best. Well, maybe there's some European ones that might give it a go. But if that's the case, if it's a small European country trying it, then you'd think that people are going to want to watch for, give it 4 or 5 years before they start saying, well, we really should have done that. So yeah, you're a decade away.
I mean, what European country is going to do it when they don't have their own central bank?
Oh, I guess
UK or...
Or Norway.
Oh, yes. Yeah, one of the fringe guys, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
And or Sweden, actually. Sweden. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, very good. Shall we shift across to the investment outlook, gents? And let's throw out for any final questions from our audience as well.
I think there was a question. There was a couple of questions there that... there's one actually from Peach. I thought that was worth anything. So he's just making the comment that higher income earners that are going to enjoy the tax cuts are the ones who are best positioned to buy houses. And he's got a very good point there, that there's a distribution issue right across the entire economy, which is because there's so much money being thrown at the economy to try and keep things going, it doesn't get evenly distributed. And so you end up with your Solomon Lews and people like that who are like, who are basically getting all this extra cash and making record profits despite having half their stores closed. And that's the same sort of as you filter down, there's plenty of people who are doing really well out of this, and then plenty of people are doing poorly. And it means that I think there's that whole idea of that distribution means that the people who are doing well can buy houses and can buy stocks and sort of help to push the markets. But there's a limit to part of that's because we're not letting the negative happen. And at some stage, you do have to let the negative happen, but how far away that is, I don't know. Dave or Leith, do you have any thoughts on tax cuts going to the best position to buy houses?
Look,
absolutely.
It's stupid policy, obviously. Obviously, when it comes to stimulus, you want to get the biggest bang for your buck. You also want to try and improve social equity, reduce inequality, et cetera, et cetera. So obviously giving money to people that already have jobs and earn good incomes is a pretty stupid idea. And instead, they should be obviously put into areas that, like Job Seeker and Direct Stimulus. But you know, the coalition's flagged that that's what they're going to do, which means that you know, wealthy people are going to have a lot more cash. They're unlikely to spend it in the real economy, and they're likely to bid up asset prices, whether it's housing or shares. I think it's a fait accompli.
Yes. So I guess it's almost a question, you know, do they want to buy investment properties with that? Because they, you know, in light of what we're saying, it's talking about falling rents and all these other issues, or do they just want to throw another, you know, spend another million on their own house? But that'll be the interesting question, I suppose, as to which segment of the market does better. You know, I'm guessing it's more skill tilted towards saying, you know, maybe some of the upper end might have a little bit more support from that than what it would have otherwise had, but maybe it does end up back in the lower end and you know, investors falling over each other to bid house prices up.
Sorry, as I said, you know, if mortgage rates do come down to 1%, and you can still get 3% on an investment property after costs, as you can outside of Sydney and Melbourne. To me, that's a no-brainer. You know, where else do you put your money if you've got surplus cash? And, you know, presuming you're not about, you know, you're not at retirement age, you need the cash straight away. Where else do you put it other than ease and housing?
Yeah, I think 3% to me for risky assets doesn't sound like a risky nice. and illiquid assets doesn't sound like a great choice, but I can see where Australians, there's plenty of Australians who will disagree with me on that one.
Well, I mean, look, you know, Australians for a decade have been making a negative carry. So they've been, been negatively geared for a decade, and they've had no problems doing that. Obviously, they expected rising prices. But, you know, again, it gets down to where else do you put your money? And a lot of people just know housing. They feel they live in a house. They feel comfortable with a house. And I think we could easily see a lot of those tax cuts spill into housing and equities, obviously.
Yep. And there's a question just up there, Dave, on thoughts on what that means for the Aussie dollar. I'll punt that to you.
Well, I don't think I think it delays falls a little, but not really, not much, because we're really at the end of the rope here. You know, as we go down this path, it means effectively we're going to have to go into negative interest rates, even though the RBA says it won't, it will. The yield into Aussie assets will get crushed, so the carry trade comes off, and That's sort of the more hot money considerations. Anyone looking at fundamentals is going to see a zombie economy. And when we've looked at, you know, the shift in earnings forecasts for Australia versus the US, for instance, over the last couple of months, yeah, there's a distinct turning up in the US, even though its virus experience was much worse, whereas here there's none. Earnings here are completely stagnant. And this will only make them more so. And then this is, say, over the next few years where commodity prices are okay because China continues to stimulate into the COVID headwinds because, you know, it's suffering from those via a global economy. But the moment things start to pick up globally, China will immediately ease back on that debt issuance that they use to stimulate, and it'll begin to slow again into its middle income trap, which is really difficult to avoid now. And so commodity prices in Australia will come off, you know, very, very sharply again, and I think through the second half of the 20s very sharply. And so then you've got an economy that's struggling to sustain any kind of income growth, then hit with another external income shock. So, you know, the investment case for Australia is poor. Very poor. All the way through all of this, you can stimulate fiscally. There's scope on that front, but you are really fighting a rearguard action against your private sector economy. which is still three quarters of it, and it's going to be going backwards. And there's no reform on the horizon to fix any of it. Just this continual can kicking and cyclical policy that that just slowly squeezes your income to death and your domestic demand. So I think that this, it's a little bit bullish for the AUD in the short term, but anything beyond, say, 6 months, 12 months tops, it's all bearish.
Okay.
I mean, in effect, you're going to strangle your banks, your commodities are going to slowly fall, and we've done everything we can to hollow out everything else. And so to rebuild some kind of economy, you're going to have to fix your competitiveness, and that means a lower dollar.
Yeah. Well, and I think it also, as we said, it's if you're pushing interest rates down for and going into negative interest rates for houses, then yeah, you do need to the bond rates have got to come down as well.
They do, and the bigger the TFF gets, then the more that's going to weigh on the Aussie dollar. I mean that.
That's a very good point. Just there's just a one-for-one dollar anyway, isn't there? Because it's made, or not quite, but it's close to in terms of saying $1 that the central bank prints to give to a bank to lend out is a dollar that they didn't borrow from overseas.
Yeah, that's right. Plus, you know, these days probably the number one input into currency values now is not actually the yield differentials; it's the perceived level of printing money. You know, that currencies really price off now. So, you know, if you really are going to ramp into quantitative easing proper with this TFF building to sort of $500 or $600 billion, which seems very plausible to me, then that's going to be very AUD bearish.
Yep. We've got there's another one. I might punt this one back to you, Leith, given you're a Queensland positive on the Queensland. Somebody's asking a question about what do you think about Queensland having 9 out of the top 10 most mortgaged areas in Australia? And I think maybe he's talking about mortgage stress, I think, as well.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what. So there was a report, I think, by Equifax that came out a couple of days ago or whatever. But that data was looking at as of May, the mortgage deferrals as of May, so at the start of the pandemic. Right. And it showed that, about 9 out of 10 most mortgage stressed areas were in Queensland's holiday areas, like Whitsundays, Gold Coast, and Sunshine Coast. Certainly, those areas are going to struggle. At least until borders are opened up and we're back to tourism normal. But you know, I can see Brisbane, for example, looking pretty good. It's got a much more diversified economy. And to be quite frank, it's very cheap. Like, it's just good value. I can see getting a lot of interstate migration the next few years. And it's also very, very, it's got much tighter supply with population growth already rising as dwelling construction's falling. So, certainly you can't just go and throw a dart at a dartboard in Queensland and think you're going to do well out of it. There are riskier areas, especially those, like, you know, heavy tourist-centric areas which have been smashed.
And it is worth noting that that's on our in that report that I put out earlier this week. Brisbane in terms of relative to where it's traded in the past. If you look at the mortgage cost to rent cost or the mortgage cost to wages, it's at sort of 40-year lows in terms of affordability. In terms of that perspective, the flip side is, there's also obviously other things going on, but the affordability relative to of rents relative to rents which are falling relative to mortgages is very good in Brisbane.
And also Perth to me looks like I haven't actually looked at Nucleus's calculator, but from stuff I've done, Fizz looks incredibly cheap. I mean, it's fallen in nominal terms by about 22% in the last 6 years, and rents are down, although rents have also fallen by about the same amount. But, you know, Perth's population growth starting to pick up quite seriously, and its construction has absolutely, you know, been smashed. So it's Perth's obviously very cheap, but it's also got its economy's turning around pretty quickly. And And it's got very, very tight supply at the moment. So I can see Perth has been has gone on a bit of a bull run as well.
Mm. Excellent.
Very good. Shall we sort of have a look at the investment wrap-up?
Yes.
Yeah. Jump across. Cautious outlook.
Yeah, that's right. It hasn't turned us around. Look, I think one of the key things from this is the bond market is worth noting that, you know, there's the New Zealand government spoke about the possibility of having negative interest rates and promptly their 5-year rate went negative. So you know, Australian bond yields are still pretty high relative to the rest of the world. If you looked and said, you know, what type of return can I get for this thing over a 10-year or 20-year basis? As a hold to maturity asset, the returns are still very low. But we do think there's this option value in the bonds that, you know, is worth playing at this point in time. There's some benefit in Aussie dollar where quite careful in terms of, you know, markets have sort of last month in September were quite negative, but have certainly recovered in the last week or so. We're still relatively bearish on the whole outlook, and we're coming into a period now with the election coming up that we think you are going to see some market volatility, and so we have our shopping list of things we want, and we're, you know, as different assets are going down and up, we're trying to shift our asset allocation in and out of those different ones, and we think for most people in your superannuation or within your ordinary investments, that's going to be necessary over the next few years is just being that little bit more tactical than what you've been in the past, because it's a volatile market and we have very low returns.
Hmm. Okay, very good. All right, well, look, thanks very much, gentlemen. Great chat today. Terrific topic. Plenty more to come on it, I'm sure. We'll jump across to our viewer question of the week as well. Is easy credit the only answer to stop falls in Australian property? So very interested to hear your thoughts. For viewers listening in, feel free to drop them in either the live chat in YouTube or, of course, over at nicholaswealth.com/webinar, and we can put those together and perhaps added into a future show as well, of course. Coming up next week, we have the start of a two-part series entitled Is Growth the New Yield? With special guest David Lane. So David's the founder and director of the wealth management part of the respected national accounting firm Pitcher Partners. He'll be joining us live from Brisbane. After 5 years of falling RBA rates and the fact that income needs are rising against falling safe investment returns, exactly what David was just talking about before, what can clients do? Growth was good before March this year, but what about now? Is it a short-term hit to growth or is it something more sustained? And how can this be used to provide income when other avenues are now unsatisfactory? So really looking forward to David's views alongside our own in where we can potentially use growth assets as a form of income. It's an interesting thought. So tune in next week, Thursday, 12:30 p.m. on the 8th of October for that live chat. And of course, we'll be available over the nicholaswealth.com webinar/webinar page to ask questions along the way. Thanks again to all of those that have watched in live for another great episode. And for all of those who have asked some questions and put your comments in as well, I hope you've taken away some great ideas. If you'd like to see more of our content, head over to nicholaswealth.com/content to stay up to date with news from us. Follow us on social media. We always appreciate guest and topic suggestions. So if you've got one, drop them in the comments of today's YouTube video. And if you, of course, if you know of anyone who might get something out of today's episode, share with a friend and let them know about it and help our show grow. So on that note, thanks very much for tuning in, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.